devolution has taken, partly because, like many others, he sadly misunderstands natural selection to be random and meaningless. He makes heavy use of what may be called the argument from personal incredulity. In the course of one chapter, we find the following phrases in this order.
There seems no explanation on Darwinian grounds. It is no easier to explain. It is hard to understand. It is not easy to understand. It is equally difficult to explain. I do not find it easy to comprehend. I do not find it easy to see. I find it hard to understand. It does not seem feasible to explain. I cannot see how Neo-Darwinism seems inadequate to explain many of the complexities of animal behavior. It is not easy to comprehend how such behavior could have evolved solely through natural selection. It is impossible. How could an organ so complex evolve? It is not easy to see. It is difficult to see.
The argument from personal incredulity is an extremely weak argument, as Darwin himself noted. In some cases it is based upon simple ignorance. For instance, one of the facts that the bishop finds it difficult to understand is the white colour of polar bears.
As for camouflage, this is not always easily explicable on neo-Darwinian premises. If polar bears are dominant in the Arctic, then there would seem to have been no need for them to evolve a white-coloured form of camouflage.
This should be translated.
I personally, off the top of my head, sitting in my study, never having visited the Arctic, never having seen a polar bear in the wild, and having been educated in classical literature and theology, have not so far managed to think of a reason why polar bears might benefit from being white.
In this particular case, the assumption being made is that only animals that are preyed upon need camouflage. What is overlooked is that predators also benefit from being concealed from their prey. Polar bears stalk seals resting on the ice. If the seal sees the bear coming from far enough away, it can escape. I suspect that, if he imagines a dark, grizzly bear trying to stalk seals over the snow, the bishop will immediately see the answer to his problem. The polar bear argument turned out to be almost too easy to demolish, but in an important sense this is not the point. Even if the foremost authority in the world can't explain some remarkable biological phenomenon, this doesn't mean that it is inexplicable. Plenty of mysteries have lasted for centuries and finally yielded to explanation. For what it is worth, most modern biologists wouldn't find it difficult to explain every one of the bishop's 35 examples in terms of the theory of natural selection, although not all of them are quite as easy as the polar bears. But we aren't testing human ingenuity. Even if we found one example that we couldn't explain, we should hesitate to draw any grandiose conclusions from the fact of our own inability. Darwin himself was very clear on this point. There are more serious versions of the argument from personal incredulity, versions which do not rest simply upon ignorance or lack of ingenuity. One form of the argument makes direct use of the extreme sense of wonder which we all feel when confronted with highly complicated machinery, like the detailed perfection of the echolocation equipment of bats. The implication is that it is somehow self-evident that anything so wonderful as this could not possibly have evolved by natural selection. The bishop quotes with approval G. Bennett on spider webs.
It is impossible for one who has watched the work for many hours to have any doubt that neither the present spiders of this species nor their ancestors were ever the architects of the web, or that it could conceivably have been produced step by step through random variation. It would be as absurd to suppose that the intricate and exact proportions of the Parthenon were produced by piling together bits of marble.
It's not impossible at all. That is exactly what I firmly believe, and I have some experience of spiders and their webs. The bishop goes on to the human eye, asking rhetorically and with the implication that there is no answer,
how could an organ so complex evolve?
This is not an argument. It is simply an affirmation of incredulity. The underlying basis for the intuitive incredulity that we all attempted to feel about what Darwin called organs of extreme perfection and complication is, I think, twofold. First, we have no intuitive grasp of the immensities of time available for evolutionary change. Most skeptics about natural selection are prepared to accept that it can bring about minor changes, like the dark coloration that has evolved in various species of moth since the Industrial Revolution. But, having accepted this, they then point out how small a change this is. As the bishop underlines, the dark moth is not a new species. I agree that this is a small change, no match for the evolution of the eye or of echolocation. But equally, the moths only took 100 years to make their change. 100 years seems like a long time to us, because it is longer than our lifetime. But to a geologist, it is about 1,000 times shorter than he can ordinarily measure. Eyes don't usually fossilize, so we don't know how long our type of eye took to evolve its present complexity and perfection from nothing, but the time available is several 100 million years. Think, by way of comparison, of the change that man has wrought in a much shorter time by genetic selection of dogs. In a few hundreds, or at most thousands, of years, we have gone from wolf to Pekingese, bulldog, Chihuahua, and St. Bernard.
Ah, but they are still dogs, aren't they? They haven't turned into a different kind of animal.
Yes, if it comforts you to play with words like that, you can call them all dogs. But just think about the time involved. Let's represent the total time it took to evolve all these breeds of dog from a wolf by one ordinary walking pace. Then, on the same scale, how far would you have to walk in order to get back to Lucy and her kind, the earliest human fossils that unequivocally walked upright? The answer is about 2 miles. And how far would you have to walk in order to get back to the start of evolution on Earth? The answer is that you would have to slog it out all the way from London to Baghdad. Think of the total quantity of change involved in going from wolf to Chihuahua, and then multiply it up by the number of walking paces between London and Baghdad. This will give some intuitive idea of the amount of change that we can expect in real natural evolution. The second basis for our natural incredulity about the evolution of very complex organs like human eyes and bat ears is an intuitive application of probability theory. Bishop Montefiore quotes C.E. Raven on cuckoos. These lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, which then act as unwitting foster parents. Like so many biological adaptations, that of the cuckoo is not single, but multiple. Several different facts about cuckoos fit them to their parasitic way of life. For instance, the mother has the habit of laying in other birds' nests, and the baby has the habit of throwing the host's own chicks out of the nest. Both habits help the cuckoo succeed in its parasitic life. Raven goes on,
"It will be seen that each one of this sequence of conditions is essential for the success of the whole, yet each by itself is useless. The whole opus perfectum must have been achieved simultaneously. The odds against the random occurrence of such a series of coincidences are, as we have already stated, astronomical."
Arguments such as this are in principle more respectable than the argument based on sheer, naked incredulity. Measuring the statistical improbability of a suggestion is the right way to go about assessing its believability. Indeed, it is a method that we shall use in this book several times. But you have to do it right. There are 2 things wrong with the argument put by Raven. First, there is the familiar, and I have to say rather irritating, confusion of natural selection with randomness. Mutation is random. Natural selection is the very opposite of random. Second, it just isn't true that each by itself is useless. It isn't true that the whole perfect work must have been achieved simultaneously. It isn't true that each part is essential for the success of the whole. A simple, rudimentary, half-cocked echolocation system, cuckoo parasitism system, etc., is better than none at all. Without an eye, you are totally blind. With half an eye, you may at least be able to detect the general direction of a predator's movement, even if you can't focus a clear image. And this may make all the difference between life and death. These matters will be taken up again in more detail in the next 2 chapters.
Chapter 3. Accumulating Small Change. We have seen that living things are too improbable and too beautifully designed to have come into existence by chance. How then did they come into existence? The answer, Darwin's answer, is by gradual step-by-step transformations from simple beginnings, from primordial entities sufficiently simple to have come into existence by chance. Each successive change in the gradual evolutionary process was simple enough, relative to its predecessor, to have arisen by chance. But the whole sequence of cumulative steps constitutes anything but a chance process when you consider the complexity of the final end product relative to the original starting point. The cumulative process is directed by non-random survival. The purpose of this chapter is to demonstrate the power of this cumulative selection as a fundamentally non-random process. If you walk up and down a pebbly beach, you will notice that the pebbles are not arranged at random. The smaller pebbles typically tend to be found in segregated zones running along the length of the beach, the larger ones in different zones or stripes. The pebbles have been sorted, arranged, selected. A tribe living near the shore might wonder at this evidence of sorting or arrangement in the world, and might develop a myth to account for it, perhaps attributing it to a great spirit in the sky with a tidy mind and a sense of order. We might give a superior smile at such a superstitious notion and explain that the arranging was really done by the blind forces of physics, in this case, the action of waves. The waves have no purposes and no intentions, no tidy mind, no mind at all. They just energetically throw the pebbles around, and big pebbles and small pebbles respond differently to this treatment, so they end up at different levels of the beach. A small amount of order has come out of disorder, and no mind planned it.
The waves and the pebbles together constitute a simple example of a system that automatically generates non-randomness. The world is full of such systems. The simplest example I can think of is a hole. Only objects smaller than the hole can pass through it. This means that if you start with a random collection of objects above the hole, and some force shakes and jostles them about at random, after a while the objects above and below the hole will come to be non-randomly sorted. The space below the hole will tend to contain objects smaller than the hole, and the space above will tend to contain objects larger than the hole. Mankind has, of course, long exploited this simple principle for generating non-randomness in the useful device known as the sieve. The solar system is a stable arrangement of planets, comets, and debris orbiting the Sun, and it is presumably one of many such orbiting systems in the universe. The nearer a satellite is to its Sun, the faster it has to travel if it is to counter the Sun's gravity and remain in stable orbit. For any given orbit, there is only one speed at which a satellite can travel and remain in that orbit. If it were traveling at any other velocity, it would either move out into deep space or crash into the Sun, or move into another orbit. And if we look at the planets of our solar system, lo and behold, every single one of them is traveling at exactly the right velocity to keep it in its stable orbit around the Sun. A blessed miracle of provident design? No, just another natural sieve. Obviously, all the planets that we see orbiting the Sun must be traveling at exactly the right speed to keep them in their orbits, or we wouldn't see them there because they wouldn't be there. But equally obviously, this is not evidence for conscious design. It is just another kind of sieve. Sieving of this order of simplicity is not, on its own, enough to account for the massive amounts of non-random order that we see in living things. Nowhere near enough. Remember the analogy of the combination lock. The kind of non-randomness that can be generated by simple sieving is roughly equivalent to opening a combination lock with only one dial. It is easy to open it by sheer luck. The kind of non-randomness that we see in living systems, on the other hand, is equivalent to a gigantic combination lock with an almost uncountable number of dials. To generate a biological molecule like hemoglobin, the red pigment in blood, by simple sieving, would be equivalent to taking all the amino acid building blocks of hemoglobin, jumbling them up at random, and hoping that the hemoglobin molecule would reconstitute itself by sheer luck. The amount of luck that would be required for this feat is unthinkable and has been used as a telling mind-boggler by Isaac Asimov and others.
The hemoglobin molecule consists of four chains of amino acids twisted together. Let us think about just one of these four chains. It consists of 146 amino acids. There are 20 different kinds of amino acids commonly found in living things. The number of possible ways of arranging 20 kinds of thing in chains 146 links long is an inconceivably large number, which Asimov calls the hemoglobin number. It is easy to calculate, but impossible to visualize the answer. The first link in the 146 long chain could be any one of the 20 possible amino acids. The second link could also be any one of the 20, so the number of possible two link chains is 20 times 20, or 400. The number of possible three link chains is 20 times 20 times 20, or 8,000. The number of possible 146 link chains is 20 times itself 146 times. This is a staggeringly large number. A million is a one with six noughts after it. A billion, 1,000 million, is a one with nine noughts after it. The number we seek, the hemoglobin number, is, near enough, a 1 with 190 noughts after it. This is the chance against happening to hit upon hemoglobin by luck. And a hemoglobin molecule has only a minute fraction of the complexity of a living body.
Simple sieving on its own is obviously nowhere near capable of generating the amount of order in a living thing. Sieving is an essential ingredient in the generation of living order, but it is very far from being the whole story. Something else is needed. To explain the point, I shall need to make a distinction between single-step selection and cumulative selection. The simple sieves we've been considering so far in this chapter are all examples of single-step selection. Living organization is the product of cumulative selection. The essential difference between single-step selection and cumulative selection is this. In single-step selection, the entities selected or sorted, pebbles or whatever they are sorted once and for all. In cumulative selection, on the other hand, they reproduce, or in some other way, the results of one sieving process are fed into a subsequent sieving, which is fed into, and so on. The entities are subjected to selection or sorting over many generations in succession. The end product of one generation of selection is the starting point for the next generation of selection, and so on for many generations. It is natural to borrow such words as reproduce and generation, which have associations with living things, because living things are the main examples we know of things that participate in cumulative selection. They may in practice be the only things that do, but for the moment I don't want to beg that question by saying so outright.
Sometimes clouds, through the random kneading and carving of the winds, come to look like familiar objects. There is a much-published photograph taken by the pilot of a small aeroplane of what looks a bit like the face of Jesus staring out of the sky. We've all seen clouds that reminded us of something, a seahorse, say, or a smiling face. These resemblances come about by single-step selection, that is to say, by a single coincidence. They are, consequently, not very impressive. The resemblance of the signs of the zodiac to the animals after which they are named, Scorpio, Leo, and so on, is as unimpressive as the predictions of astrologers. We don't feel overwhelmed by the resemblance, as we are by biological adaptations, the products of cumulative selection. We describe as weird, uncanny, or spectacular the resemblance of, say, a leaf insect to a leaf, or a praying mantis to a cluster of pink flowers. The resemblance of a cloud to a weasel is only mildly diverting, barely worth calling to the attention of our companion. Moreover, we are quite likely to change our mind about exactly what the cloud most resembles, as this scene from Hamlet shows.
Do you see yonder cloud that's almost in shape of a camel?
By the mass, and 'tis like a camel indeed.
Methinks it is like a weasel.
It is backed like a weasel.
Or like a whale?
Very like a whale.
I don't know who it was first pointed out that, given enough time, a monkey bashing away at random on a typewriter could produce all the works of Shakespeare. The operative phrase is, of course, given enough time. Let us limit the task facing our monkey somewhat. Suppose that he has to produce not the complete works of Shakespeare, but just the short sentence, "Methinks it is like a weasel," and we shall make it relatively easy by giving him a typewriter with a restricted keyboard, one with just the 26 capital letters and a space bar. How long will he take to write this one little sentence? The sentence has 28 characters in it, so let us assume that the monkey has a series of discrete tries, each consisting of 28 bashes of the keyboard. If he types the phrase correctly, that is the end of the experiment. If not, we allow him another try of 28 characters. I don't know any monkeys, but fortunately my 11-month-old daughter was an experienced randomizing device, and she proved only too eager to step into the role of monkey typist. Here is what she typed on the computer.
UMMK CDZZ F ZD DSDSKSM, etc. for another 140 characters.
She had other important calls on her time, so I was obliged to program the computer to simulate a randomly typing baby or monkey.
WDLDMNLT P Y YVMQKZP.
And so on and on. It isn't difficult to calculate how long we should reasonably expect to wait for the random computer, or baby or monkey, to type, "Methinks it is like a weasel."
Think about the total number of possible phrases of the right length that the monkey or baby or random computer could type. It is the same kind of calculation as we did for hemoglobin, and it produces a similarly large result. There are 27 possible letters, counting space as one letter, in the first position. The chance of the monkey happening to get the first letter, M, right, is therefore 1 in 27. The chance of it getting the first two letters, M-E, right, is the chance of it getting the second letter, E, right, 1 in 27, given that it has also got the first letter, M, right. Therefore, 1/27th times 1/27th, which equals 1/729th. The chance of it getting the first word, "methinks," right, is 1/27th for each of the eight letters, therefore 1/27th times 1/27th, etc., eight times, or 1/27th to the power 8. The chance of it getting the entire phrase of 28 characters right is 1/27th to the power 28, in other words, 1/27th multiplied by itself 28 times. These are very small odds, about 1 in 10,000 million, 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 million. To put it mildly, the phrase we seek would be a long time coming, to say nothing of the complete works of Shakespeare.
So much for single-step selection of random variation. What about cumulative selection? How much more effective should this be? Very, very much more effective. Perhaps more so than we at first realize, although it is almost obvious when we reflect further. We again use our computer monkey, but with a crucial difference in its program. It begins by choosing a random sequence of 28 letters just as before. It now breeds from this random phrase. It duplicates it repeatedly, but with a certain chance of random error, mutation, in the copying. The computer examines the mutant nonsense phrases, the progeny of the original phrase, and chooses the one which, however slightly, most resembles the target phrase, "Methinks it is like a weasel." In this instance, the winning phrase of the next generation was not an obvious improvement. But the procedure is repeated, again mutant progeny, a bred from the phrase, and a new winner is chosen. This goes on generation after generation. After 20 generations, the phrase chosen for breeding was
Meldinsels it's zwirrk ze wexel.
By now the eye, or ear, of faith fancies that it can detect a resemblance to the target phrase. By 30 generations there can be no doubt.
Methinks it is like ber wexel.
Generation 40 takes us to within one letter of the target.
Methinks it is like I weasel.
And the target was finally reached in generation 43. A second run of the computer reached the target phrase in generation 64. In a third run, the computer reached "Methinks it is like a weasel" in 41 generations of selective breeding. The exact time taken by the computer to reach the target doesn't matter. If you want to know, it completed the whole exercise for me the first time while I was out to lunch. It took about half an hour. Computer enthusiasts may think this unduly slow. The reason is that the program was written in BASIC, a sort of computer baby talk. When I rewrote it in Pascal, it took 11 seconds.
Computers are a bit faster at this kind of thing than monkeys, but the difference really isn't significant. What matters is the difference between the time taken by cumulative selection and the time which the same computer, working flat out at the same rate, would take to reach the target phrase if it were forced to use the other procedure of single-step selection. About a million, 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 million years. This is more than a million, million, million times as long as the universe has so far existed. Actually, it would be fairer just to say that, in comparison with the time it would take either a monkey or a randomly programmed computer to type our target phrase, the total age of the universe so far is a negligibly small quantity, so small as to be well within the margin of error for this sort of back-of-an-envelope calculation. Whereas the time taken for a computer working randomly but with the constraint of cumulative selection to perform the same task is of the same order as humans ordinarily can understand between 11 seconds and the time it takes to have lunch. There is a big difference, then, between cumulative selection, in which each improvement, however slight, is used as a basis for future building, and single-step selection, in which each new try is a fresh one. If evolutionary progress had had to rely on single-step selection, it would never have got anywhere. If, however, there was any way in which the necessary conditions for cumulative selection could have been set up by the blind forces of nature, strange and wonderful might have been the consequences. As a matter of fact, that is exactly what happened on this planet, and we ourselves are among the most recent, if not the strangest and most wonderful, of those consequences.
It is amazing that you can still read calculations like the hemoglobin calculation, used as though they constituted arguments against Darwin's theory. The people who do this, often expert in their own field, astronomy or whatever it may be, seem sincerely to believe that Darwinism explains living organization in terms of chance, single-step selection, alone. This belief, that Darwinian evolution is random, is not merely false, it's the exact opposite of the truth. Chance is a minor ingredient in the Darwinian recipe, but the most important ingredient is cumulative selection, which is quintessentially non-random. Clouds are not capable of entering into cumulative selection. There is no mechanism whereby clouds of particular shapes can spawn daughter clouds resembling themselves. If there were such a mechanism, if a cloud resembling a weasel or a camel could give rise to a lineage of other clouds of roughly the same shape, cumulative selection would have the opportunity to get going. Of course, clouds do break up and form daughter clouds sometimes, but this isn't enough for cumulative selection. It is also necessary that the progeny of any given cloud should resemble its parent more than it resembles any old parent in the population. This vitally important point is apparently misunderstood by some of the philosophers who have in recent years taken an interest in the theory of natural selection. It is further necessary that the chances of a given cloud surviving and spawning copies should depend upon its shape. Maybe in some distant galaxy these conditions did arise, and the result, if enough millions of years have gone by, is an ethereal, wispy form of life. This might make a good science fiction story, the white cloud it could be called, but for our purposes a computer model like the monkey Shakespeare model is easier to grasp. Although the monkey Shakespeare model is useful for explaining the distinction between single-step selection and cumulative selection, it is misleading in important ways. One of these is that, in each generation of selective breeding, the mutant progeny phrases were judged according to the criterion of resemblance to a distant ideal target. The phrase methinks it is like a weasel. Life isn't like that. Evolution has no long-term goal. There is no long-distance target, no final perfection to serve as a criterion for selection. although human vanity cherishes the absurd notion that our species is the final goal of evolution. In real life, the criterion for selection is always short-term, either simple survival or, more generally, reproductive success. If, after the eons, what looks like progress towards some distant goal seems, with hindsight, to have been achieved, this is always an incidental consequence of many generations of short-term selection. The watchmaker that is cumulative natural selection is blind to the future and has no long-term goal.
We can change our computer model to take account of this point. We can also make it more realistic in other respects. Letters and words are peculiarly human manifestations, so let's make the computer draw pictures instead. Maybe we shall even see animal-like shapes evolving in the computer by cumulative selection of mutant forms. We shan't prejudge the issue by building in specific animal pictures to start with. We want them to emerge solely as a result of cumulative selection of random mutations. In real life, the form of each individual animal is produced by embryonic development. Evolution occurs because, in successive generations, there are slight differences in embryonic development.
These differences come about because of changes, mutations, this is the small random element in the process, in the genes controlling development. In our computer model, therefore, we must have something equivalent to embryonic development and something equivalent to genes that can mutate. There are many ways in which we could meet these specifications in a computer model. I chose one and wrote a program that embodied it. We will now consider this computer model in some detail because it is revealing. If you don't know anything about computers, just remember that they are machines that do exactly what you tell them, but often surprise you in the result.
Embryonic development is far too elaborate a process to simulate realistically on a small computer. We must represent it by some simplified analog. We must find a simple picture-drawing rule that the computer can easily obey and which can then be made to vary under the influence of genes. What drawing rule shall we choose? Textbooks of computer science often illustrate the power of what they call recursive programming with a simple tree-growing procedure. The computer starts by drawing a single vertical line. Then the line branches into two. Then each of the branches splits into two sub-branches. Then each of the sub-branches splits into sub-sub-branches, and so on. It is recursive because the same rule, in this case a branching rule, is applied locally all over the growing tree. No matter how big the tree may grow, the same branching rule goes on being applied at the tips of all its twigs. The depth of recursion means the number of sub-sub-branches that are allowed to grow before the process is brought to a halt. At deep levels of recursion, the pattern becomes quite elaborate, but is still produced by the same very simple branching rule. This is, of course, just what happens in a real tree. The branching pattern of an oak tree or an apple tree looks complex, but it really isn't. The basic branching rule is very simple. It is because it is applied recursively at the growing tips all over the tree, branches make sub-branches, then each sub-branch makes sub-sub-branches and so on, that the whole tree ends up large and bushy. Recursive branching is also a good metaphor for the embryonic development of plants and animals generally. Not that animal embryos look like branching trees, they don't, but all embryos grow by cell division. Cells always split into two daughter cells, and genes always exert their final effects on bodies by means of local influences on cells and on the two-way branching patterns of cell division. An animal's genes are never a grand design, a blueprint for the whole body. The genes, as we shall see, are more like a recipe than a blueprint, and a recipe, moreover, that is obeyed not by the developing embryo as a whole, but by each cell or each local cluster of dividing cells. The embryo, and later the adult, does indeed have a large-scale form, but this large-scale form emerges because of lots of little local cellular effects all over the developing body, and these local effects consist primarily of two-way branchings in the form of two-way cell splittings. It is by influencing these local events that genes ultimately exert influences on the adult body. The simple branching rule for drawing trees, then, looks like a promising analogue for embryonic development. Accordingly, we wrap it up in a little computer procedure, label it development, and prepare to embed it in a larger program labelled evolution. As a first step towards writing this larger program, we now turn our attention to genes. How shall we represent genes in our computer model? Genes in real life do two things. They influence development, and they get passed on to future generations. In real animals and plants, there are tens of thousands of genes, but we shall modestly limit our computer model to 9. Each of the 9 genes is simply represented by a number in the computer, which will be called its value. The value of a particular gene might be, say, 4 or minus 7.
How shall we make these genes influence development? There are lots of things they could do. The basic idea is that they should exert some minor quantitative influence on the drawing rule we call development. For instance, one gene might influence the angle of branching, another might influence the length of some particular branch. Another obvious thing for a gene to do is to influence the depth of the recursion, the number of successive branchings. I made gene 9 have this effect. I shan't spell out in detail what each of the other 8 genes did, but by changing the value of each, plus 1 and minus 1 for each gene, I could then have printed out a ring of 18 mutants around the central tree. The reason for 18 is that there are 9 genes, and each one can mutate in an upward direction, 1 is added to its value, or in a downward direction, 1 is subtracted from its value. So a ring of 18 trees would be enough to represent all possible single-step mutants that you can derive from the one central tree. Each of these trees has its own unique genetic formula, the numerical value of its 9 genes. This is true of real genes too. Genes only start to mean something when they are translated via protein synthesis into growing rules for a developing embryo. And in the computer model too, the numerical values of the 9 genes only mean something when they are translated into growing rules for the branching tree pattern. But you can get an idea of what each gene does by comparing the bodies of 2 organisms known to differ with respect to that particular gene.
This, too, is exactly what real-life geneticists do. Geneticists normally don't know how genes exert their effects on embryos, but by comparing the bodies of 2 adult animals that are known to differ according to a single gene, they can see what effects that single gene has. It's more complicated than that because the effects of genes interact with each other in ways that are more complicated than simple addition. Exactly the same is true of the computer trees, very much so, as later examples will show.
All the tree shapes were symmetrical about a left-right axis. This is a constraint that I imposed on the development procedure. I did it partly for aesthetic reasons, partly to economize on the number of genes necessary. If genes didn't exert mirror image effects on the 2 sides of the tree, we'd need separate genes for the left and the right sides, and partly because I was hoping to evolve animal-like shapes, and most animal bodies are pretty symmetrical. For the same reason, from now on I shall stop calling these creatures trees and shall call them bodies or biomorphs. Biomorph is the name coined by Desmond Morris for the vaguely animal-like shapes in his surrealist paintings. These paintings have a special place in my affections because one of them was reproduced on the cover of my first book. Desmond Morris claims that his biomorphs evolve in his mind and that their evolution can be traced through successive paintings. Back to the computer biomorphs and the ring of 18 possible mutants. Since each member of the ring is only one mutational step away from the central biomorph, it is easy for us to recognize them as children of the central parent. We have our analogue of reproduction, which, like development, we can wrap up in another small computer program, ready to embed in our big program called evolution. Note 2 things about reproduction. First, there is no sex. Reproduction is asexual. I think of the biomorphs as female, therefore, because asexual animals like greenfly are nearly always female. Second, My mutations are all constrained to occur one at a time. A child differs from its parent at only one of the 9 genes. Moreover, all mutation occurs by +1 or -1 being added to the value of the corresponding parental gene. These are just arbitrary conventions. They could have been different and still remain biologically realistic.
The same is not true of the following feature of the model, which embodies a fundamental principle of biology. The shape of each child is not derived directly from the shape of the parent. Each child gets its shape from the values of its own 9 genes, influencing angles, distances, and so on. And each child gets its 9 genes from its parent's 9 genes. This is just what happens in real life. Bodies don't get passed down the generations. Genes do. Genes influence embryonic development of the body in which they are sitting. Then those same genes either get passed on to the next generation or they don't. The nature of the genes is unaffected by their participation in bodily development, but their likelihood of being passed on may be affected by the success of the body that they helped to create. That is why in the computer model it is important that the two procedures called development and reproduction are written as two watertight compartments. They are watertight except that reproduction passes gene values across to development, where they influence the growing rules. Development most emphatically does not pass gene values back to reproduction. That would be tantamount to Lamarckism, which will be discussed in Chapter 11.
We have assembled our two program modules then, labelled development and reproduction. Reproduction passes genes down the generations with the possibility of mutation. Development takes the genes provided by reproduction in any given generation and translates those genes into drawing action, and hence into a picture of a body on the computer screen. The time has come to bring the two modules together in the big program called evolution. Evolution basically consists of endless repetition of reproduction. In every generation, reproduction takes the genes that are supplied to it by the previous generation and hands them on to the next generation, but with minor random errors, mutations. A mutation simply consists in +1 or -1 being added to the value of a randomly chosen gene. This means that as the generations go by, the total amount of genetic difference from the original ancestor can become very large cumulatively, one small step at a time. But although the mutations are random, the cumulative change over the generations is not random. The progeny in any one generation are different from their parent in random directions, but which of those progeny is selected to go forward into the next generation is not random. This is where Darwinian selection comes in. The criterion for selection is not the genes themselves, but the bodies whose shape the genes influence through development. In addition to being reproduced, the genes in each generation are also handed to development, which grows the appropriate body on the screen, following its own strictly laid down rules. In every generation, a whole litter of children, i.e. individuals of the next generation, is displayed. All these children are mutant children of the same parent, differing from their parent with respect to one gene each. This very high mutation rate is a distinctly unbiological feature of the computer model. In real life, the probability that a gene will mutate is often less than 1 in 1,000,000. The reason for building a high mutation rate into the model is that the whole performance on the computer screen is for the benefit of human eyes, and humans haven't the patience to wait 1,000,000 generations for a mutation.
The human eye has an active role to play in the story. It is the selecting agent. It surveys the litter of progeny and chooses one for breeding. The chosen one then becomes the parent of the next generation, and a litter of its mutant children are displayed simultaneously on the screen. The human eye is here doing exactly what it does in the breeding of pedigree dogs or prize roses. Our model, in other words, is strictly a model of artificial selection, not natural selection. The criterion for success is not the direct criterion of survival, as it is in true natural selection. In true natural selection, if a body has what it takes to survive, its genes automatically survive because they are inside it. So the genes that survive tend to be, automatically, those genes that confer on bodies the qualities that assist them to survive. In the computer model, on the other hand, the selection criterion is not survival, but the ability to appeal to human whim. Not necessarily idle, casual whim, for we can resolve to select consistently for some quality such as resemblance to a weeping willow. However, the human selector is more often capricious and opportunistic. This too is not unlike certain kinds of natural selection. The human tells the computer which one of the current litter of progeny to breed from. The genes of the chosen one are passed across to reproduction, and a new generation begins. This process, like real-life evolution, goes on indefinitely. Each generation of biomorphs is only a single mutational step away from its predecessor and its successor. But after 100 generations of evolution, the biomorphs can be anything up to 100 mutational steps away from their original ancestor. And in 100 mutational steps, much can happen.
I never dreamed how much when I first started to play with my newly written evolution program. The first thing that surprised me was that the biomorphs can pretty quickly cease to look like trees. The basic two-way branching structure is always there, but it is easily smothered as lines cross and recross one another, making solid masses of color. For example, one particular evolutionary history consisted of no more than 29 generations. The ancestor was a tiny creature, a single dot. Although the ancestor's body was a dot, like a bacterium in the primeval slime, hidden inside it was the potential for branching in exactly the pattern of the basic tree. It is just that its gene 9 told it to branch 0 times. What I now describe is only the successful child of each generation, i.e. the parent of the next generation, the one main line of evolution guided by my aesthetic selection. The dot became a Y shape in generation 2. In the next two generations, the Y became larger. Then the branches became slightly curved, like a well-made catapult. In generation 7, the curve was accentuated so that the two branches almost met. The curved branches got bigger, and each acquired a couple of small appendages in generation 8. In generation 9, these appendages were lost again, and the stem of the catapult became longer. Generation 10 looked like a section through a flower, the curved side branches resembling petals, cupping a central appendage or stigma. In generation 11, the same flower shape became bigger and slightly more complicated.
Each generation was just a little different from its parent and from its sisters. Since each was a little different from its parent, it's only to be expected that each will be slightly more different from its grandparents and its grandchildren, and even more different still from its great-grandparents and great-grandchildren. This is what cumulative evolution is all about, although, because of our high mutation rate, we have speeded it up here to unrealistic rates.
When I wrote the program, I never thought that it would evolve anything more than a variety of tree-like shapes. I had hoped for weeping willows, cedars of Lebanon, Lombardy poplars, seaweeds, perhaps deer antlers. Nothing in my biologist's intuition, nothing in my 20 years' experience of programming computers, and nothing in my wildest dreams prepared me for what actually emerged on the screen. I can't remember exactly when in the sequence it first began to dawn on me that an evolved resemblance to something like an insect was possible. With a wild surmise, I began to breed generation after generation from whichever child looked most like an insect. My incredulity grew in parallel with the evolving resemblance. Generation 29 revealed an insect-like biomorph, many times larger than its early ancestors, bearing what appeared to be an elaborate set of antlers. Admittedly, the last few generations had 8 legs like a spider instead of 6 like an insect, but even so. I still cannot conceal from you my feeling of exultation as I first watched these creatures emerging before my eyes. I distinctly heard the triumphal opening chords of Also sprach Zarathustra, the 2001 theme in my mind. I couldn't eat, and that night my insects swarmed behind my eyelids as I tried to sleep.
There are computer games on the market in which the player has the illusion that he is wandering about in an underground labyrinth which has a definite, if complex, geography and in which he encounters dragons, minotaurs, or other mythic adversaries. In these games, the monsters are rather few in number. They are all designed by a human programmer, and so is the geography of the labyrinth. In the evolution game, whether the computer version or the real thing, the player, or observer, obtains the same feeling of wandering metaphorically through a labyrinth of branching passages, but the number of possible pathways is all but infinite, and the monsters that one encounters are undesigned and unpredictable.
On my wandering through the backwaters of Biomorph Land, I have encountered fairy shrimps, Aztec temples, Gothic church windows, Aboriginal drawings of kangaroos, and on one memorable but unrecapturable occasion, a passable caricature of the Wickham Professor of Logic. Shapes evolved which closely resembled a tree frog, a standard lamp, a bee-like orchid, a scorpion, a lunar landing craft, and a Spitfire plane, among many others. The role of the human eye was limited to selecting, among randomly mutated progeny, over many generations of cumulative evolution.
We now have a more realistic model of evolution than the monkeys typing Shakespeare gave us. But the biomorph model is still deficient. It shows us the power of cumulative selection to generate an almost endless variety of quasi-biological form, but it uses artificial selection, not natural selection. The human eye does the selecting. Could we dispense with the human eye and make the computer itself do the selecting on the basis of some biologically realistic criterion? This is more difficult than it may seem. It's worth spending a little time explaining why.
It is trivially easy to select for a particular genetic formula, so long as you can read the genes of all the animals. But natural selection doesn't choose genes directly. It chooses the effects that genes have on bodies, technically called phenotypic effects. The human eye is good at choosing phenotypic effects, as is shown by the numerous breeds of dogs, cattle, and pigeons. To make the computer choose phenotypic effects directly, we should have to write a very sophisticated pattern recognition program. Pattern recognizing programs exist. They're used to read print and even handwriting. But they are difficult, state-of-the-art programs, needing very large and fast computers. Even if such a pattern recognition program were not beyond my programming capabilities, and beyond the capacity of my little 64-kilobyte computer, I wouldn't bother with it. This is a task that is better done by the human eye, together with, and this is more to the point, the 10-giga-neuron computer inside the skull.
It wouldn't be too difficult to make the computer select for vague, general features like, say, tall thinness, short fatness, perhaps curvaceousness, spikiness, even rococo ornamentation. One method would be to program the computer to remember the kinds of qualities that humans have favoured in the past and to exert continued selection of the same general kind in the future. But this isn't getting us any closer to simulating natural selection. The important point is that nature doesn't need computing power in order to select, except in special cases like peahens choosing peacocks. In nature, the usual selecting agent is direct, stark, and simple. It is the Grim Reaper. Of course, the reasons for survival are anything but simple. That is why natural selection can build up animals and plants of such formidable complexity. But there is something very crude and simple about death itself, and non-random death is all it takes to select phenotypes, and hence the genes that they contain, in nature.
To simulate natural selection in an interesting way in the computer, we should forget about rococo ornamentation and all other visually defined qualities. We should concentrate instead upon simulating non-random death. Biomorphs should interact in the computer with a simulation of a hostile environment. Something about their shape should determine whether or not they survive in that environment. Ideally, the hostile environment should include other evolving biomorphs, predators, prey, parasites, competitors. The particular shape of a prey biomorph should determine its vulnerability to being caught, for example, by particular shapes of predator biomorphs. Such criteria of vulnerability should not be built in by the programmer. They should emerge in the same kind of way as the shapes themselves emerge. evolution in the computer would then really take off, for the conditions would be met for a self-reinforcing arms race discussed in Chapter 7, and I dare not speculate where it would all end. Unfortunately, I think it may be beyond my powers as a programmer to set up such a counterfeit world. If anybody is clever enough to do it, it would be the programmers who develop computer games. In these programs, a counterfeit world is simulated. It has a geography, often in three dimensions, and it has a fast-moving time dimension. Entities zoom around in simulated three-dimensional space, colliding with each other, shooting each other down, swallowing each other. So good can the simulation be that the player receives a powerful illusion that he himself is part of the counterfeit world. But even modern game programs are small fry compared to the program that would have to be written to simulate an emerging arms race between predators and prey, embedded in a complete counterfeit ecosystem. There is a popular cliché, usually uttered in the tone Stephen Potter would have called plonking, which says that you cannot get out of computers any more than you put in. Other versions are that computers only do exactly what you tell them to, and that therefore computers are never creative. The cliché is true only in a crashingly trivial sense, the same sense in which Shakespeare never wrote anything except what his first schoolteacher taught him to write, words. I programmed evolution into the computer, but I did not plan my insects, nor the scorpion, nor the spitfire, nor the lunar lander. I had not the slightest inkling that they would emerge, which is why emerge is the right word. True, my eyes did the selecting that guided their evolution, but at every stage I was limited to a small clutch of progeny offered up by random mutation, and my selection strategy, such as it was opportunistic, capricious, and short-term. I was not aiming for any distant target, and nor does natural selection. I can dramatize this by discussing the one time when I did try to aim for a distant target. First, I must make a confession. You will have guessed it anyway. The 29-generation evolution which I described earlier is a reconstruction. When my insects originally emerged to the sound of trumpets, I had no means of recording their genes. There they were, sitting on the computer screen, and I couldn't get at them, couldn't decipher their genes. I delayed switching the computer off while I racked my brain trying to think of some way of saving them, but there was none. The genes were too deeply buried, just as they are in real life. I could print out pictures of the insects' bodies, but I had lost their genes. I immediately modified the program so that in future it would keep accessible records of genetic formulae, but it was too late. I had lost my insects. I set about trying to find them again. They had evolved once, so it seemed that it must be possible to evolve them again. Like the lost chord, they haunted me. I wandered through biomorph land, moving through an endless landscape of strange creatures and things, but I couldn't find my insects. I knew that they must be lurking there somewhere. I knew the genes from which the original evolution had started. I had a picture of my insects' bodies. I even had a picture of the evolutionary sequence of bodies leading up to my insects, by slow degrees from a dot ancestor. But I didn't know their genetic formula. You might think that it would have been easy enough to reconstruct the evolutionary pathway, but it wasn't. The reason, which I shall come back to, is the astronomical number of possible biomorphs that a sufficiently long evolutionary pathway can offer, even when there are only 9 genes varying. Several times on my pilgrimage through biomorph land, I seemed to come close to a precursor of my insects, but then, in spite of my best efforts as a selecting agent, evolution went off on what proved to be a false trail. Eventually, during my evolutionary wanderings through biomorph land, the sense of triumph was scarcely less than on the first occasion, I finally cornered them again. I didn't know, still don't, if these insects were exactly the same as my original lost chords of Zarathustra insects, or whether they were superficially convergent, a term which will be explained in the next chapter. But it was good enough. This time there was no mistake. I wrote down the genetic formula, and now I can evolve insects whenever I want. Yes, I'm piling on the drama a bit, but there is a serious point being made. The point of the story is that even though it was I that programmed the computer, telling it in great detail what to do, nevertheless I didn't plan the animals that evolved, and I was totally surprised by them when I first saw their precursors. So powerless was I to control the evolution that, even when I very much wanted to retrace a particular evolutionary pathway, it proved all but impossible to do so. I don't believe I would ever have found my insects again if I hadn't had a printed picture of the complete set of their evolutionary precursors, and even then it was difficult and tedious.
Does the powerlessness of the programmer to control or predict